Good morning, everyone. Today we have Dan Kennedy with us. We've got a special teleseminar. Appreciate everyone who's called in this early morning here on the West Coast and everywhere else. I'm going to start with just a brief introduction here, and then we'll kind of dive into some questions and review just kind of some new and what's going on with Dan. Everyone, I think, knows Dan, but for those of you who don't, Dan is a serial entrepreneur, an author, speaker, investor, consultant, and definitely one of the world's best and highest paid copywriters. I've personally mailed letters that Dan has written and seen them generate millions of dollars. Today, we're going to be talking about Dan's updated version of his No BS book on time management for entrepreneurs. And so, Dan, welcome to the call. I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Craig. Happy to be here.
Wonderful. Well, to get us started, can you tell us a little bit, going back in time in your career, when did you realize that you needed to start managing your time differently than the rest of the business world?
Fairly early. The full portfolio of methods, strategies, tactics, procedures, rules, if you will, in this third edition of the book evolved over years. But the fundamental foundation for it, the first chapter of viewing it as investment, not as spend, viewing it as money, and treating other people's access to it and self-management of it more like money than minutes on the face of a watch. That was really very early. And it became very clear to me that income differential in almost any given activity has an enormous amount to do with what I would call exclusive attention, to what extent you are able to really concentrate and focus your energy and your resources, including your time, on one high-value activity at a time, and how you are able to protect that from other people. All of the highest paid writers of our time, if you read their own descriptions of how they work, or if you were able to observe them, so Stephen King, James Patterson, these people, there's not a single one of them who is writing their books on their laptops at Starbucks. Now, there's a lot of poor, stupid writers who are trying to do that, but you won't catch any of the highest income ones doing it because when they go to do that, they want to give it exclusive attention. You will find poor, dumb salespeople talking to customers or would-be customers on their smartphones while they are driving their car or peeing at the urinal. You won't find any real high-income sales pros doing that. So in any endeavor, it became pretty clear to me that the winners were behaving about this as well as pretty much about everything else, but were behaving about this very differently than the mediocre majority and the losers. So most people essentially spend their time randomly, governed by circumstances and events, and they permit democratized access to their time, governed by whoever, shows up. And if you do that with your money, so however much money you have, really wouldn't matter how much. If you had a lot, if you just doled it out to whoever showed up asking for it in whatever amount they asked for, in whatever order they showed up, you would pretty quickly not only be out of money, but you would have dispensed it in largely unproductive, low or no return on investment ways. If you take all your money and put it in a big box out in the middle of your office or place of business and put a sign on it that says, take however much you need, or however much you feel entitled to, whenever you want, you will not only soon be out of money, but the money will have disappeared in ways that will give you very low or no return on investment. And really, nobody is dumb enough to do this with their money. But there's a whole lot of people who are dumb enough to do it with their time. I'm not one of them.
Right.
And I figured that out pretty damn early. If you forced me to peg it, I would peg it at 1975.
Oh, wow. Really early in your career. Okay. Well, I think one of the concepts that when I first met you and that it was completely new to me and that you talk a lot about in your book is this concept of setting up your base earning target. And you have this base earning target, you know, in mind, and you set up your schedule and things. You look at things totally different because of that. And so for those listening in, can you talk a little bit about what does it mean to have a base earning target and how do you use that into managing your time in your business?
Okay, so broadly, it's reverse engineering. And so if you, and I think you did actually, if I'm not mistaken, if you were going to build a new home, you start working with an architect and you develop what the thing is supposed to be when it's done. And then you engineer everything backwards. And the same thing is true of everything except the way people deal with their time and their money. They actually don't do much reverse engineering. They may state a financial goal. I want to make X amount of dollars a year or this year. But then they don't reverse engineer backwards from that in order to schedule the achievement of that goal on a hour by hour, day by day, week by week, month by month, investment of time by investment of time basis. But that's actually what's necessary if that income number is anything of size. And so now narrower, this means you have to go through a mathematical process, which is in the book, to arrive at a conclusion about what your minutes and hours must be worth in order to achieve the income, and if you're even more sophisticated about it, the wealth goal and goals going forward. Without this number, you can't do anything intelligently. So you get that number. Now, you have to work with time budgets the same way you would work with money budgets. So if you want to arrive at a 7.2% yield on your money for the year, you can't make too many investments that yield 1%. Because think of the top-end yield you will need to arrive at a 7.2% average. So bank CDs are literally out of the question. Well, when you do time budgets, you start to see the same things. Okay? You really can't afford to go to lunch three times a week with the same three boobs you work with who bring nothing new to the discussion. They can't connect you with useful contacts. You can't learn anything from them. In many cases, they may be negative, critical, and toxic influences. And if you invest 6 hours a week going to lunch with them, you're buying a 1% CD from the bank, and you cannot possibly overcome the drag of that with more productive investments of other hours. Every investment of time now has to be informed by the return on investment value, the size and scope of the opportunity, the worth of the activity or the task. So even something like writing this book, it is preordained with the maximum number of hours it can have. By that, I then know, for example, how many pages have to be done every 15 minutes. If I fall very far behind, I've bought 1% CDs, and there's no way I will make up the difference. So I have to stay apace. I have to stay on schedule. I have to be conscious of it, not 12 hours into it, gee, how are we doing? No, 12 minutes into it, how are we doing? And so this whole time as money, while a cliche, and a lot of people will mouth the cliche but not behave in any way that would honor it, it's more than a cliche. It's a reality. And there's five or six things about your time that absolutely govern your bank balance, that absolutely govern your income and your accruing and accumulating wealth. And if you aren't managing the time, you will find it impossible to manage the money. You can set all the financial goals you want, and you will not achieve them if you are not setting time investment goals and managing those as well.
And that's really, you know, what the main purpose of this book is about, you know, turning time into wealth, and the whole concept of how you manage every single day and how you approach it. It's a totally different view on how we look at, you know, going to work every day versus the traditional method of going out and just trying to make as much as you can. You've already thought about, this is how much I need to make in order to reach my goal. So every minute you have to account for that it's going to be making or earning towards that end goal that you want.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can tell you now, today, of a certain amount of certain income that is on the books for 2018, tied to various and sundry activities. And I can also tell you how many hours or days those activities are going to consume and are going to be allowed to consume. I can also tell you some likely income, but not certain, and the hours or days that will consume. So I can already tell you for 2018 what percentage of the way I am to my income goal. I can tell you what percentage of my available time has been consumed by that number. I can tell you how many dollars are left to find sources for. I can tell you how many hours are left in order to accommodate those sources, which will govern in large part decisions about the sources. So, for example, I contracted a fairly big project for next year with a client, and it includes me speaking at four of their events. I refuse to enter the contract unless two of those events are held here in my home city, because if all four of them, even though I fly private, had a day and a half of travel attached to them, too many hours would be used for the income that is available, thereby putting me in a hole that I have to overcome somehow with something else that I am not certain or confident can be found and achieved, so I can't permit the whole. And everything has to be looked at this way. And so most people use what in economics are called trailing indicators. Hardly anybody uses a lot of predictive indicators. I will tell you that your actual achievement of goals is going to be totally determined by predictive indicators. The really smart head coach of a football team can tell you whether he's going to be in the playoffs or not. He's not going to tell his players, but he can tell you with virtual certainty whether he's going to make the playoffs or not this year by the end of the first week of the season, totally based on predictive indicators. How many blocks did the lineman miss? How many yards did they give up? How many red zone plays by the opponent did they stop? What is the strength of their schedule going forward? Hundreds of predictive indicators, and he will be able to know with relative certainty whether he's going to be in the playoffs or not. Now he can, based on that, try and make adjustments and make them as quickly as he can in order to rejigger all the predictive indicators and take another look at the end of the second week of the season and see whether he's improved his probability any and what adjustments can be made again. And for the most part, in the NFL, by the fourth week of the season, it's all over. The fans don't know it. A lot of the players don't know it. But the statisticians know it. It's past the point of return for adjustments. And this is true of humans in their month-to-month, year-to-year business activities, and for a business itself. It isn't really very long into the term of a goal before you've passed the point of no return, you've passed the point of ability to make adjustments to achieve that goal. It's over because you didn't use predictive indicators and manage, amongst other things, time with those predictive indicators. And this is why people keep moving their goalposts quarter by quarter, year by year, decade by decade, all through their life, is because they failed to manage the resources, notably their time, with predictive indicators, so they didn't keep falling into a hole that they can't climb out of by the time they wanted to be out of it. And so most people just move the goalposts. We have a whole generation right now of family business, private practice owners who are reaching the year that they intended to retire and having to move the goalposts because they don't have enough money and they can't sell the business for what they thought they were going to sell the business for. And they've had 40 years to get there. Well, they were probably doomed by the eighth year of the 40. And it had as much to do with how they managed their time as it did with how they managed the money. And so getting a grip on this, and getting a grip on it now, not later, is really very important.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, it's obviously critical to the success of your business. I remember when I first met you and I first read one of the early editions of the No BS Time Management for Entrepreneurs book. Might have been the first or second edition, I don't remember which one. I had this vendor. I was printing millions of pieces with this printer. And he would call me and want to talk on the phone for like an hour at a time. And it would be two or three times a week. And from his perspective, I was his biggest client. So he wanted to, you know, keep that relationship. And so he felt like spending lots of time on the phone with me was a good thing. And I would just, you know, reluctantly do it, thinking, okay, this is what I've got to do. And after reading the book and talking to you, it changed my mindset completely, and I had to go to this printer and say, hey, look, you're sucking all the time out of my week. You've got 30 minutes a week. That's it. we've got to go through the business related things, and that's all I can do. I'm sorry. And after a week or two of trying to get this concept across to him, I had to cut him off. I had to change vendors. And doing that actually saved me like a day and a half, a month of wasted time on the phone. But it was only until I realized that I was not making money on those phone calls. I was losing money, and it wasn't turning my time into wealth. It was a complete waste. So there's a lot of...
Depending on the value of your time, the monetary value of your time, the vendor you switch to could be X percentage more expensive and still be the bargain because of the recaptured time. And so people don't think about that. See, they don't think like investors. And so is that time given to this, in this case, vendor, a good investment? Well, no. Well, therefore, you can't allow it. Now, if you want to socialize with the guy on time you have allocated for social activities, by all means, bring him to your backyard barbecue. Take him to a ball game that you were going to go to the ball game anyway, and you have time allocated. And when you do your math, that's in the book, you do that. You don't calculate the value of your time based on the total amount of work hours there are in a year. That's like the stupidest seminar exercise ever devised. My math that I give you in the book, you calculate the value your hour must have based on the number of actual hours you are going to devote to productive activity, which subtracts out the hours you want to go to ball games, golf, ski, play pool, play video games, go to your kids' games, all of these things. So you get to a realistic number of what your hour has to be worth. And then you look at that hour and a half and you say, there's no way I can make this investment. I mean, it's just off the table. The other thing about that I would point out to people is you are not required to be quote-unquote fair about this. In fact, you can't be. The reciprocity can't apply. The democratization of time can't apply because different people's time has different value. So for me to let a vendor, let's say it's the guy who takes care of all my classic cars and keeps my cars running, for me to let him call me randomly whenever he feels a need or a desire and interrupt me is insane, because it takes the value of my time down to the value of his time. The value of my time has to exceed $3,400 an hour. The value of his time is probably around $80 an hour if he even thinks about it. If I let him randomly take my time, he is forcing me to invest my time in him, and the value is enormously disproportionate. However, if I want an immediate response from him, I have no compunction about picking up the phone and calling him and disrupting his life. In fact, I do it all the time. An instant answer is most valuable to me. Getting it in the quickest way possible is most valuable to me. He answers his phone, so 9 out of 10 times I'm going to get him. I'm not going to play phone tag. And my time is worth $3,400 an hour plus, and his isn't. So me taking his time, I feel no guilt. I can't feel any guilt. So there's no, if you want to think of this as injustice, feel free. But it's necessary injustice if you are going to be a top performer and a high incomer.
Yeah, and that is just it's a complete mindset thing that we really have to change from from right now moving forward. You can't just slowly work into this. You really have to start setting up your parameters of how you're going to do this and plan it out and be intentional about it versus just letting it happen. You really have to think through everything you're doing to make sure that it sticks with the plan. I want to change gears to something that I think is really important that we cover today, and it's one of the title of the chapter is Taming Tech and Surviving the Social Media Swamp, which, you know, more and more business owners are becoming buried with this constant connection to their phone or their tablet or their computer. And I would love for you to share some of your time management philosophy when it comes to technology.
Well, not only are they allowing themselves to be consumed by it, they are allowing their employees, their staff to be consumed by it. And so they're really drug addicts who are sharing the cocaine with everybody. Or if you want to be more charitable, their employees are all cocaine addicts who are sharing it with the boss. So the first thing to determine, and there is a test for it in the chapter you reference, is whether or not you are an addict and whether or not you are employing one or more addicts. Because addiction requires a certain response. And there are an enormous number of people who now, I mean, I've been talking about this for a decade, but the research and the dialogue about it is catching up to me. There is an acknowledgement that this is a legitimate and real addiction. A lot of people are actual addicts, and they cannot control by decision and will alone their addiction. So some reformed alcoholics can actually go sit at a bar, socialize, and drink Perrier and pull that off. Others cannot. Their addiction is emotional, intellectual, chemical, physiological, and they cannot put themselves in that environment, or they are going to once again be owned by their addiction. The same thing is true with a device and with social media and so forth. So the first thing people have to do is determine, are they just engaging in stupid behavior? Or are they actually in the grip of addiction? And the chapter talks about what to do if you or you have staff who are in the grip of an addiction and what to do if you are just engaging in stupid behavior. So stupid behavior is, for example, if you are trying to be a highly productive person and you are trying to achieve a very high level of income from productive things, then you do not strap your television set to your back and drag it and load up a knapsack with games and drag it around with you everywhere you go so that the millisecond something else isn't going on, you set up your TV and watch it and you dump your games out and play with them and get interested in what you're doing and now play for 3 hours without going back to doing anything productive. You don't leave your work every day to go to the mall for 3 hours and shop. But that's what a lot of people do in the workplace now with Amazon. You don't check 5 times a day to see if you got an email. You do that once a day. Well, the same thing is true with email, texts, post to your social media site and so forth. So the old saying is everything in its place and a place for everything. So games belong in a game closet, and they belong played with on time allocated and budgeted for entertainment or recreation. They don't belong let loose into your every minute, every hour environment. That's stupid. Now, if you happen to have an addiction, it's beyond stupid. It's putting yourself in an impossible situation. But either way, it shouldn't happen. And the same thing should not be permitted to occur with your staff. So you need to address this swamp that is like quicksand and sucks people in and sucks them in more and more and more and more. You need to address it, first of all, by thinking about it in terms of offline equivalents. So a lot of people get really messed up about all this because it's online and therefore it is different. But if you think about it in terms of offline equivalents, this is helpful. So let's take shopping. And you have an employee who is supposed to be doing something productive for you 6 hours a day, less breaks and lunch break. So would you allow them to continue to use their breaks and lunch break the way they do, plus let them leave the office 4 times during the day for a half an hour at a time to go over to the mall and shop? How long would they keep their job? Therefore, you can't let that happen with them and Amazon. It's the same thing. It's not a different thing. Addiction. So we no longer let people smoke in most workplaces. When do they get to smoke? On their breaks and on their lunch hour. Blue collar, they go to a locker and they get their purse or they get their cigarettes. White collar, they got them with them. They go outside and they stand in the parking lot and they shiver in the winter and they smoke. And then they get their ass back to work and they don't smoke. And we allow them, because they are addicted, to even do this. Same thing with any personal use of a device. Breaks, lunch, go get it, go stand outside, shiver in the winter, use it if you must, then put it away, get your ass back to work. And if you have to hire and fire 5 times as many people, to find people who will perform this way, it's the bargain of the century. Because what's happening with the complete distraction, the complete invasion, the complete usurpation, is not only damaging to the quantity of work being done, it's damaging to the quality of the work being done, all the way to the point of dangerous, hazardous, harmful. So if you call Uber and you get yourself an Uber driver to drive you to the airport, and you get in the car with him and he is swilling from a fifth of whiskey while he is driving you, you are probably going to object. If you get in the Uber car and he is on his cell phone the entire time he's driving you, calling, taking calls, texting, arguing with his girlfriend, trading a stock, placing his bet on the game, most people today are not going to object. Yet, the research is inarguable. The second kind of behavior is more hazardous than the first kind. You'd be better off with the drunk driver than you would be with the digitally distracted driver. They are the same things. They are not different. And it is your responsibility to say, excuse me, while you drive me to the airport, please put your phone aside. I'd like your hands on the steering wheel in the 10 o'clock and the 2 o'clock position where they belong. And I'd like your attention on the road. Thank you very much. And the more we refuse to do this, the more we tolerate this stupid and or addicted behavior in others, the more we become accepting enough of it that we do it too. So the backwash, the principle of association, is like the law of gravity. You really don't get to defy it very long. The backwash of it is not only damaging to your business and the people in it, it is damaging to you if by no other means than the backwash. If you let everybody in your workplace use cocaine, it's a 99% certainty that you are going to try cocaine. It's virtually guaranteed. Maybe not this week, maybe not next week, but soon. And it's a relative certainty that the person who tries cocaine uses cocaine again and again, and pretty soon is cocaine addicted. If you tolerate everybody coming into meetings, sitting at the boardroom table, being in a seminar, being in a training class in your workplace, being at lunch with you, putting their phone on the table in front of them, accessing it, using it, seeing how many likes they got in the last hour, it is only a matter of time before you are engaged in the same behavior. So all of this is mission critical to avoid at all costs, at any cost. And by the way, all of the top executives in Silicon Valley behave very differently than they are selling everybody else on behaving. If you were privy, you would know that most of them actually live by this book, not by the book they would have you live by. The number one private academy, junior high school and high school in Silicon Valley, that the executives send their kids to, prohibits devices on campus. All of the schools they have you sending your kids to mandate having devices on campus. Every kid's got to have one. And the homework gets transmitted by it, and the teacher wants to be texted, not the kid coming to the office, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they actually, if you were able to follow 10 top executives of the 10 top tech companies are out for a week, you would find them behaving very much like I've described in this book. They and I are simpatico, but they don't want you to know it.
And I'm just
and
curious.
It is my contention, which I make in the book, no more than 15 years from now, and probably 10, the Facebooks of the world are going to be the tobacco companies. The executives are going to be testifying before Congress about what they knew and when they knew it. It is going to be revealed they knew they were deliberately engineering addiction into their products, and knew it, but were not, of course, disclosing it or cautioning against it. At least the drug peddlers, so the current opioid crisis, is today's tobacco scandal. But at least they have had warning labels from the beginning. These folks do not do that. They are, in fact, lying in the other direction. But this is going to be the tobacco scandal, next up in line probably behind the opioid scandal.
And this technology, I mean, you've been talking about it for years, talking about how it can be, you know, a huge time suck and a waste of, you know, becoming an addictive part of people's lives, which we're obviously seeing. And just curiosity, so a lot of people know that your main form of correspondence is fax, and I imagine it's tied to this in some way. And you don't have a cell phone, and you're very limited on the way that people can communicate with you. You're not checking email all day long because you don't have email. Can you maybe talk a little bit about your philosophy and how that works? And I mean, I'm always fascinated with your schedule and how you're able to break it up and say, okay, this day here I'm dealing with faxes, and just maybe a little bit about your communication and how that ties into the management of your personal time.
So the easier it is for people to communicate with you, the more they communicate with you. So if you let people text you, you're going to get a lot of texts. If you let them text you with no barriers, with no controls, so if your employees are allowed to text you, if that printer was allowed to text you, you would get a lot of texts randomly from him. If you were going to let him text you at all, you do exactly what you did with the phone. You can text me. if you must. I look at texts on Tuesday and Thursday from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock. So be sure you text between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock. If you text any other time, we just delete them. So, and a staff person does it. So don't bother. See, all of this can be used effectively, but you have to think about it as very dangerous. So dynamite's useful if you need to, out in the middle of, you know, raw farmland, you need to blow a big tree out of the ground. Dynamite's fine. But if you're going to drive it out there in an old rusty pickup truck and just throw it in the back of the truck and let it bounce around, you may very well blow yourself up before you get to the tree. Medical marijuana is very useful. However, it's loose dynamite in the back of a pickup truck. Opioids are useful, but it's loose dynamite in the back of a pickup truck. And you got to at least know it. And you got to impose protocols and controls and procedures. So nobody has to go as far as I do. However, a lot of people actually should, because they prove unable to control the other easier access stuff. So what happens with me, particularly, is with very rare exceptions, all phone calls are pre-scheduled by appointment, and they are cluster booked, as you alluded to. So there's one day a month for all phone appointments, if humanly possible, in that day. As a practical matter, in most months there will be, on two or three other days, a two-hour window into which two or three phone calls have to be clumped. They're always clumped. And there is no, somebody just calls me and I pick up the phone, or they leave a message and I play phone tag. There's none of that. To further restrain it, I don't carry a cell phone. I don't own one. And I don't want to own one, by the way. So should anybody be sending a Christmas present and thinking they're doing me a favor, don't. I have no interest whatsoever. The requirement of the fax versus an email versus a text, even versus the phone, because there's more delay for people communicating with me by phone than there is fax. I get them every week. And if one is genuinely urgent, I may get it forwarded to me the same day. It slows down communication. So the easier it is, the more, every time somebody has a brain fart, they send a text or they send an email. That's why you got 400 emails in your inbox. It wasn't that you had 400 necessary communications. You had 40 necessary communications from 10 people. They should have been summarized. They should have been organized. They should have come to you as one. Instead, they came in pieces. You are now taking your time to sort and sift the pieces together. Or, dumber, you are responding to each piece with a piece. So again, think of the online equivalent, or the offline equivalent, excuse me. So there's a chapter in the book all about time vampires. An old-fashioned time vampire who still exists is the guy who comes to your office door nine times a day, hangs there until you look up and acknowledge him, and he says, "I just need a minute." And he's got an item. It never takes a minute, by the way, but he's got an item. You can't tolerate this. And the cure for it, first of all, is not being there, but the second cure is, "No, Bob, I don't have a minute." and we have a scheduled 20-minute meeting every Thursday. Please take all the stuff you need a minute for, organize it, prioritize it, and bring it with you on a list to our meeting on Thursday. That's when we're going to deal with everything. Bye. Well, all your unrestricted email inbox is a doorway, and Bob hanging there six times a day until you acknowledge him, and he sends you six emails. It's the same crap, and it's the same solution. One email a week, Bubba. Organize everything, prioritize it, and I'd like it on Thursday between noon and 5. Bye. So it's the same stuff, right?
Right.
But since a lot of people can't discipline themselves to behave with the online media in this manner, then they are better off not using it at all. So the fax forces somebody to be thoughtful. It forces them to communicate in complete sentences. It forces them to organize their thoughts. Email does that less. Text does it even less. Unfettered phone call does it less. So this is a control mechanism that safeguards my time. It also, and some people become grateful for it, others don't, but it actually improves the value and productivity of other people's time because it stops them from being thoughtless and casual and sloppy and communicating poorly and communicating in pieces. So they will tell you, people will tell you, you'll read, as you saw some of them in the book, just as you're in the book, they will tell you, A, they hated all this to start with. B, they gradually came to realize that their relationship with me was the most productive relationship they had because of what I was compelling them to do. And then finally, they began to implement some version of it with at least some of the people in their businesses and their lives to their benefit, having been taught it and trained on it. So the book is really a summary of all this. It is an answer to questions like the one you just raised and the many other questions that can be raised. It is a permission slip to try and give you the brass balls to do it. And it is the scripts, the mechanisms, the rules of engagement to use if you are going to do it.
And I want to encourage everyone that's listening in here that even if you've read the first or second edition of the No BS Time Management for Entrepreneurs book, the third edition, this most recent one being released, does have updated information. I read it and I found new things and highlighted new information, and it is something that you want to get your hands on. And Dan and I are only able to scratch the surface of it today. So I do want to encourage everyone to go out to Amazon or a bookseller or Barnes & Noble and pick up a copy. And Dan, I know we only have a few minutes left, but something I think is really important to touch in on is the concept that you talk about is tapping into a mastermind. And how does that tie into time management and being productive?
Well, so time, you can only do so much with your own time. And by connection, your own talent, your own capability, your own resources. Buffett can be brilliant. And Buffett can every morning get up and begin accessing financial information and doing his own research and doing his own thinking. However, were he not also buying research from a variety of research sources, were he not also in a two-person mastermind with Charlie Munger, were he not in an internal group mastermind with members of his team, Were he not in a mastermind with Bill Gates? Were he not accessing other people's intelligence and experience and current and contemporary experience, Buffett would be nowhere near as effective and has have as great a win-loss ratio and be as wealthy and has fortune-making for others as he is. So being in formal mastermind groups, paying to be there with a capable leader who is being paid to lead it, is one approach. And it is, I think, due to the increasing complexity of almost any kind of business, it is a very useful thing to do in industry. So you've been in the Titanium Group I run for Info Marketers. Essentially, you are multiplying past knowledge and current experience by the number of people in that group. You even have formal ride sharing, right? Here's five concepts of what we might do to improve our businesses. By myself, to test all five of them is going to take 5 months. If we divvy them up and everybody tests a different one, all the tests are run a month. It gets to the time value of money. And so that's a very useful kind of mastermind. Internal masterminds matter. If you have people around you on your team who aren't useful enough by their own outside study, their own outside experience, their own outside networking, in order to really contribute, you got a problem. So you want to meet with them. The informal, these are the most difficult to pull off and make valuable. But the informal masterminds, like Napoleon Hill wrote about in Think and Grow Rich, between Harvey Firestone, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, all somewhat related to the auto industry and meeting informally but frequently. The relationship Buffett has with Gates, these are the informal mastermind environments. All of them have a place, and they are all about leverage. They are all about multiplying the value of your time by some fraction of each person's contribution to the whole. So it's not like you're in a mastermind group with five and you just multiplied the value of your time by five. It doesn't work that way. But if each one added a fifth, you've doubled the value of your time. And it's very hard to do it any other way.
Right, and it touches in on something you started with when you're talking about if you meet with the same three guys for lunch, and you want to grow, and they're going to recommend the 1% return on going through the bank, you've got to change who you're meeting with and spending your time with, and you've got to find the right group to mastermind with, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Well, that's right. Look, there might be three guys that would pay you for all three of you to have lunch once a week. Harvey Firestone, Henry Ford, and, maybe. But more likely, less frequently than that. But more importantly, you better find a way to have lunch with different people every so often, to get different perspectives. And we've narrowed our focus on everything. If you think about media, there's people that only watch Fox News because it verifies their worldview. There's other people that only watch MSNBC because it verifies their worldview. Well, all they're doing is solidifying a smaller and smaller and narrower worldview. Doesn't mean you're going to change your opinions, but you are going to discover stuff that you never even hear about if you watch a little bit of MSNBC and a little bit of Fox. There's people that read the Wall Street Journal every day but never read a copy of Cosmopolitan. Well, if they have women as customers, they're idiots. right? Every once in a while, you need to read Cosmopolitan. So the same thing is true of the people you choose to hang out with. If all you do is tight, narrow, peer matches, you're Amish. And there's not a lot of innovation that has come out of the Amish. There's not a lot of improvement that has come out of the Amish. The big innovation in farming has been two mules hooked to a plow instead of one. So you do have to be careful of the environments you put yourself in, the groups you put yourself in, how tightly you limit all of that, how broadly you and indiscriminately you do all of that, and you do it all with, again, what your hour has to be worth to achieve your goals as a guiding light.
And I know, Dan, that our time with you is coming to an end here. I don't want to overextend our welcome here with you, and I appreciate the time that you spent with us. And for those listening in, I really encourage you to go out and get the updated edition of the No BS Time Management for Entrepreneurs book. Dan, it's been a pleasure, and we just thanks for having you on the call today.
Thanks, Craig.
All right. For those of you listening in here, I'm going to go ahead and end this. I will send out a recorded copy for everyone so that you can listen to it again or pass along and share it with others. I hope everyone has a wonderful Thanksgiving and holiday season. And this concludes this teleseminar. Thanks for calling.